Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhoman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhoman. You know, over the past few months, I've received a half dozen or so requests from listeners seeking a more in-depth conversation on GMOs. For many of us, it's a murky subject with a great deal of misinformation and concern. Well, you've asked, and today we're lucky to be joined by an expert in the space that will shed some light on many of the mysteries, falsehoods, and those concerns associated with genetic engineering of our food, and more broadly, our relationship with natural order. Early this month, I was down in Baltimore, Maryland, at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health Symposium on Ethics in Food and Production. The gathering was called Choose Food and brought together these experts in their fields, each fighting for a more stable and just tomorrow. The presenting expert on genetics and capacity for manipulation was Kevin Esfeld, who's the director of MIT Media Lab Sculpting Evolution Group, which invests in new ways to study and influence the evolution of ecosystems by carefully developing and testing these methods with openness and humility, the group seeks to address difficult and ecological problems for the benefit of humanity and the natural world. Kevin's lab is located just down the river from us in Kendall Square, and he was nice enough to join us in studio to discuss further, to share wisdom for those seeking more clarity. Hey, Kevin. How you doing?
Thanks, Aaron. That was quite the introduction. I don't know about that whole wisdom thing. I mean, isn't the whole point that that wisdom is a collective virtue, and that's why we're here to talk about these issues so then people can have conversations?
Hey, I like that. A little self-reflection back on me. I'll take it. I'll tell you, anything coming from you like that, I'm more than open for that. I did have a chance to hear your presentation down in Baltimore, and I'll say, I was impressed. You're a young guy. I mean, you're late 30s, 40 maybe, probably a little than that, but I was impressed by your ability to stand in front of this audience, a broad group of people, deep thinking folks, and field many questions from people that could have been, individuals that didn't always align with your perspective. So maybe you could share with our audience, tell us a little bit more about your work you're doing over at the Media Lab.
Well, Sculpting Evolution, people often think that it must be about biological systems because we think evolution is about biology, Charles Darwin and the like. It's about selective breeding of our dogs. It might be nowadays about genome editing because we have other ways of influencing the genome. But it's also true that technology evolves. We evolutionary biologists like to think of things evolving as moving across fitness landscapes, where you have a population that moves towards regions of higher fitness, and we can sort of envision this as a mountain range. And it's sort of a terrible metaphor for genetics because the actual landscape is hyper-astronomically vast. Mm. But it's a nice metaphor in a way you can think about the landscape. But what's interesting is that the shape of a landscape depends on the populations moving across it as much as the physical environment. That is, for a given species, its fitness depends mostly on what other members of that its same species are in that same environment that it's competing with. Then you also have what other organisms does it interact with. And all of those populations are, of course, also evolving. So you have this landscape defined by the populations evolving across it. And that's a very long-winded way of saying that evolution is really complex. It's very hard to understand, but it can be influenced by the things that are evolving. Hmm. And the same is true of technology. And my group is primarily concerned with ensuring that technology remains connected to humanity and that the ways in which we develop technology are as thoughtful and humble and cautious as possible because we live in an era defined by increasingly powerful and accessible technologies. And our record of making wise decisions is not always a good one. So we're very interested in doing what we can, not only to develop technologies that can improve the world, but also to attempt to develop ones that will change the fitness landscape for other technologies that encourage people to make wiser decisions and avoid areas of hazard.
So it's not always the tools, but whose tools the hands that are wielding them may be. It's an element here from my understanding. Let me unpack this a little bit. We are in a situation where we talk about being able to control natural order. And your point, I think, is that if we are part of natural order, then it's the normal process involved in that.
That's right. That is one of the very contentious divides is, are we part of the natural order or not? If you view us as not being part of the natural order, then technology is the very definition of the unnatural. Technology is what sets humanity apart from all other species. Not that none of them use technology, but certainly none of them use it anywhere near the level that we do.
Right.
That really is the defining characteristic that makes us different. And I think it's very hard to argue against the proposition that technology is power.
Yeah.
And so the ways in which we choose to use technology define who we are and our relationship to everything else.
Well, we can get into the weeds in a few here about what that specifically means. For the genetic engineering, for our crops, for the natural order, whatever it may be. But I think what's interesting is to look at the philosophical side of this. One of the things that you had mentioned down in Maryland, again, with that audience of individuals that I think were pretty well tooled to come back and have conflict with so many of the points that you wanted to bring up. You had mentioned that that no matter the example of potential use case that you had for genetic manipulation, which seemed to underpin your point, you always had the trump card here, which was that the cat's out of the bag, that this is happening. We're genetically engineering many different things. And before the hobbyist or the scientist with questionable ethics or intent engineer a plague, a new crop that could be a contamination or even a sibling, that we should let groups of concerned and conscious scientists like you, manage this IP. So given this to be our reality, why should we trust you and your friends?
I'm not sure I would put it that way at all, in fact.
Okay.
Rather, I would say that the moral responsibility is on the people who have the power to intervene. For many challenges facing us today, moral challenges, we did not have the technological power to do anything about the problem in question. And this is true for many ecological problems. You have diseases. People always jump to malaria. You have schistosomiasis. You have, around here, one that we tackle is Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases. Many of these problems are things that we couldn't do anything about. In agriculture, we couldn't do a whole lot about pests eating our crops. Then we developed ways of intervening, among them, say, rodenticides to kill the rodents. Most of those do not give the rodents a very clean or humane death. It's quite agonizingly painful to develop hemorrhages in your brain and to bleed out and die over the course of 48 to 72 hours. We chose to use those. And the moral consequences of that are on us. But if we chose not to use something like that, if we chose not to intervene and to let the problem continue unsolved, then the consequences of that are also on us. That is, once you develop the power to intervene, it's on you either way.
Mm-hmm.
So I grapple with this particularly because I happened to be one of the first people, possibly the first person, and certainly the first person to tell the world that it was possible to use CRISPR genome editing to affect a wild population by building something called a gene drive system. Now, this is a phenomenon that occurs in nature when a genetic element finds some way to distort inheritance in its favor. So a normal gene has a 50-50 chance of being inherited by offspring and sexually reproducing species. And some genes have some way, there's lots of different ways of doing it. It's actually an amazingly diverse and beautiful variety of different mechanisms that genes have found ways around the normal rules. But it's a very successful strategy because it's so common. It's nearly impossible to find some organism that doesn't have some genetic element somewhere in its genome that at some point hasn't broken the rules in this way, because the ones that manage to do it are very successful before the other genes manage to get together and stop them. And with CRISPR, we now have a way of duplicating this phenomenon, and that lets us potentially alter the traits of wild populations, which before wasn't possible, because normally when we alter an organism, doesn't matter if it's selective breeding or genome editing, we're diverting its resources for our benefit. And that means that when our altered organism goes out there into the ancestral habitat competing with the wild types, it doesn't have as many resources available to survive and reproduce. Mm. And that means natural selection wipes the floor with whatever we've done. To date, there are no known examples of any human altered organism outcompeting its wild counterpart in the ancestral habitat. Now, that's not saying there aren't, you know, domesticated animals that become invasive species in a new habitat, but that's a different habitat where there was a vacant ecological niche. There were no wild counterparts. But in terms of competition with wild counterparts in the ancestral habitat, there has never been a recorded case. I'm not saying it can't happen. Mm-hmm. In fact, I have a private list of different ways that we could probably do it, and it's a private list for a very good reason, because as soon as you introduce something that could potentially have an ecological advantage in the wild, you could potentially affect an entire ecosystem, and that is potentially hazardous. But with gene drive, we could potentially do that for almost any given gene by giving our engineered version an inheritance advantage. Mm. So I have to hold myself morally responsible for all the consequences of this technology. Even if somebody else uses it and screws it up in some way, I have to hold myself morally accountable for that, because as the person who told the world that this was possible and developed the first one in a working example in the laboratory, I have enough of a voice to help shape discussion over how this technology is used. Hmm. So I recently pointed out that perhaps we should not develop this technology in a for-profit manner, because there are a lot of publicly and philanthropically funded efforts focused on the highest priority applications, eradicating malaria, for example, that are threatened by scientists potentially launching for profits, because as soon as you're going to personally profit from a particular technology or application, people are naturally going to trust you less. Hmm. And in the space of GMOs, I think we see this quite clearly. So if we keep the space completely nonprofit, then we know that we can focus on what really matters. Are we making wise decisions in terms of other people, in terms of the animals in which we share the planet with, in terms of integrating over the long haul? What is this setting a precedent for? I think those decisions are more likely to turn out well for us if we don't introduce the complication of the profit motive.
Hmm. And that might be the underpinning of some of the concerns with GMOs here. And you know, I know you're so deeply into this initiative, and you see it from a very your own perspective here, where you seem to be very morally accountable for these actions. But I think that might be the real problem that people have associated with GMO, and that's why it's been bucketed, especially on the food side, is whose hands are wielding this. And the associated GMO with crop, which either infuses, a BT enzyme for a pesticide, or a glyphosate-resistant crop type, that's the kind of the standard, that's the benchmark people look at. How do you coax them out of this shielded and sheltered perspective to look at it, to your point, that this is a new iteration? These are new perspectives that are being intertwined with these new technologies.
One easy way to start is to say, you know, looking at the introduction of GM technology in agriculture, if there's a worse way to introduce a new technology, it's I'm sure we've done worse, mm-hmm. but it's hard to imagine it, because here you have applications that really don't benefit the typical consumer directly, maybe a few cents cheaper at the supermarket, not anything you're going to notice, certainly not anything obvious in terms of benefits to the people actually eating this food. That doesn't have to be the case, mind you, but it certainly was the case for almost all GM crops until very recently. And even now, pretty marginal benefits. I mean, oh, your apples don't brown.
Right.
Okay, that's nice and all, but so you didn't offer obvious benefits to most people, And the people who did benefit were, in part, the people who developed the technology. Right. And they personally profited from it. And there was essentially no public discussion. The people who ended up eating these foods did so without really knowing what was happening to the food supply and without really having any kind of a voice or knowledge of what was going on. It just seemed to happen. That's not a good way to build trust with communities, and that's not a good way to make decisions when it comes to deciding which technologies should be rolled out. Now, I personally actually rather like the BT crops because they reduce the number of, the extent of pesticide spraying that is necessary. If you can make your plant make a compound that is toxic to insects that would otherwise eat the plant, then that's less pesticide runoff, that's less non-target insects that aren't eating your plant dying. It's ecologically a better idea. So I think there's a case to be made for that. Glyphosate resistance and other kinds of herbicide and pesticide resistance so that then you can spray more, that's another story because you have a greater ecological impact. But I'm not really here to talk about existing GM foods because that is an epic disaster and no one is going to trust anything that I or anyone else says on that because it's already hardened into an issue of identity politics.
Yeah.
So what we do instead is we say, look, we don't have a for-profit concern. I'm not going to make any money from this. No one else in this room is going to make any money from this. And our whole point is that we do hold ourselves morally responsible for how this goes. And we're here because we want to hear what you think is going to go wrong. We want to hear all concerns and criticism and skepticism because we don't live here. We don't, or at least I haven't yet worked on a project that would directly affect exactly where I live. So in general, I can say we don't live here. We don't know the environment as well as you do. We are working with an ecologist who's been working here for many years, but even they don't know as much as the sum total of the people who actually live here.
Hmm.
And wisdom really is a collective virtue. And drawing on the concerns of everyone is likely to come up with potential problems that we would not think of on our own. So not only do we not want to move forwards unless the local community is actually interested in the technology, we also want to offer them different options, different ways the technology might be developed, as well as the opportunity to say, no, we're just not interested, in which case we'll walk away because I have lots of different projects that I would love to see happen in the world and make a difference, and make the world better. But if one of them, the local community, isn't interested and doesn't think it's a good idea, fine.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many ways that we could benefit the world that there's absolutely no need to proceed with something if people aren't pretty enthused about it.
Right. Yeah, I ask because I'm even though you did not create the concern, there's a bit of a bucketing. You inherited it to a certain extent. And I think you're doing a nice job, from my understanding, from what I've seen in your presentations, also reading more of doing these town halls, getting an understanding what the real concerns are, delivering information to address the misnomers, to look at this differently and say, to your point, that underpinning that, you know, not allowing for corruption or hubris or certain levels of us controlling aspects that can make us profit or personally benefit, that creates a whole new framework to build around, right? So let's talk about that. Let's talk about what you're doing over at the Media Lab and your specific expertise associated with CRISPR. Could you share with our audience a bit of what is difference with CRISPR? Maybe even get into the idea of transgenesis versus cisgenesis on the food side, or use it as a premise across the board of what other engineering could happen.
Sure. So, and again, given the topic here, I'm going to explicitly dive into GMOs and use them as a comparison.
Great.
With the understanding that normally I don't do that.
Sure. Okay.
And the reason is that as soon as you bring up the GMO issue, then you sort of force people to take sides because it has become polarized. It's become an identity politics thing. And so you bring it up and people are obviously are immediately for or against.
Okay.
So with that understanding, I'm going to point out that every GM crop on the market looks like children playing with Duplos.
Okay.
To a modern technologist.
Yeah.
That is, the tools that they had when they developed those things, they were blundering around in the dark, not knowing what they were doing, with really you know, it's amazing that they work as well as they do because they had such limited capabilities and such limited understanding of what was actually going on.
Right.
Now, I say that with the understanding that we really still don't understand biological systems. They're incredibly complex. But the introduction of tools such as CRISPR means instead of randomly throwing DNA at a genome and having it land somewhere, anywhere, we don't know necessarily where even, and then it will turn on in a way that depends on where it happened to land, and it might affect other genes around it. That was the way everything used to be done. CRISPR is a programmable molecular scalpel, and now we can read out the entire sequence of the whole genome. We can do that from a single cell, and we can decide exactly where we want to make a change, and we can introduce CRISPR, and we can program it with a sequence of bases that matches the DNA that we want to edit. And in the billions of base pairs of DNA in that cell, CRISPR will go to that one site and it will cut the DNA in one form. And that can then lead the cell to repair it using a new DNA sequence that we introduce. That DNA sequence could then change the target sequence to exactly that match that of another member of the same species. So in agriculture, there are some breeds of cattle that are born without horns, but only some breeds, because it's this naturally occurring mutation in the POLD gene, which controls horn development. Now, you don't generally want your cattle to have horns because they're dangerous both to the people working with the cows and also to the cows themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they are typically dehorned in a quite horrible process that involves a great deal of animal suffering. So it's much better if the cows just don't get horns on their own. Well, with CRISPR, we can introduce that exact same mutation that occurred naturally into breeds of cattle that didn't previously have it. And consequently, there is no more need to dehorn cattle of that breed. But we can introduce that change without having to actually cross those different breeds of cattle, which have already been selectively bred for very different purposes. So it'd be extremely inefficient to have to cross them and then cross back, then back cross over and over again to retain the hornless one. We can instead just go in and duplicate the exact sequence of DNA that occurred naturally, but in a new background. So that's what would be called a cisgenic change.
Mm-hmm.
You're just creating, you're introducing new DNA that is new to that particular genome, but is not new to the species. You're creating a mutation that already existed in members of the same species.
Sure. Just a new expression of it?
I mean, to the point where you cannot tell the difference.
Okay.
It is molecularly identical. That just wasn't possible before. And that means that we can now edit the genome to be essentially whatever we want. That doesn't mean that we know how to make a change that results in a phenotypic change, that is, the way that the organism develops in its eventual traits and behaviors. There's still an incredible amount that we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're still toddlers when it comes to really understanding that. But we do have the ability to introduce changes whose effects we know, because they're already present in some organisms of a species, into different, say, existing breeds, different populations of that same species.
Mm.
So that's the difference between CRISPR and traditional GMOs, because traditional GMOs was pretty much entirely DNA from some other species blasted at random into the genome where it happened to land somewhere, typically, you know, a couple of pieces put together to create a new trait in one way or another, say glyphosate resistance, for example.
Right.
So it's very hard to say anything in general about CRISPR-based genome editing, because it can do almost anything. What change is it? Maybe it's a change that is already present in other members of the same species and is therefore cisgenic, and it's just, there's nothing there that you could not create through selective breeding. But it also allows you to put in something from whatever other species or something that has never existed in a wild organism in the first place, that has only been evolved in the laboratory. So it depends entirely on what are you proposing to do with it.
Right.
It doesn't really make sense to judge it on the basis of how we made it. Because in the case of those hornless cattle, selective breeding could produce that exact genome.
Yep.
It would just take couple dozen generations.
Right.
And CRISPR lets us do it immediately. But are you going to judge it as different because on the molecular scale, it's identical? So why are you going to treat it differently because we made it directly rather than doing the old-fashioned slow way?
Right.
That, to me, doesn't make sense. To some people, it does. To some people, the technology itself is intensely alarming that we can do this. Some people feel that operating on this level becomes like playing God, and that the problem to them is the intent. That is, even though most crops are created through random mutations, and they're often accelerated by using chemical or radiation mutagenesis to create diversity that wouldn't otherwise normally occur, and then select for the ones you want, that it's somehow different when we know what we're doing. And what do you say to that? That's a people's intuitive sense that it's different.
Yep.
To the playing God, I can only say that, look, if a benevolent God gave us the tools to make a difference in the world and improve it, I can't imagine why he or she wouldn't want us to do that after all.
Right.
God gave us the tools, right? God gave us the good intent. God gave us, hopefully, the humility to recognize when we might go catastrophically wrong with it. To say that it's a somehow playing God, if God gave us the tools and the benevolence, then why wouldn't we?
Hmm.
How could a benevolent God want us to not do that and continue to allow animals to suffer horribly when we could intervene to prevent that?
Very interesting. Getting to the philosophical side of things, obviously, and you know, our correlation to natural order, if we're here to control it or be part of it, and if the tools are part of this mechanism of control, I understand your point. And I think the analogy, which you had mentioned before, maybe selective dog breeding being a good example in the last century of what has materialized for a Doberman Pinscher or Rottweiler, whatever you're looking to engineer for your animal, being a good example. And you know, previous to that, we did this through grafting and through hybridization, through orchards and apple trees. And that's been a bit of a facade that I'm not going to revert back to the GMO conversation, but that has been something of a facade that they've held themselves. We've been doing it for 10,000 years. There's no difference. But to your point, in looking at this as a programmable molecular scalpel, and looking at this, that you have this type of control to then define this and make it happen immediately, does it take into account, or does it give you capacity to appreciate those unintended consequences?
I don't think the technology, unfortunately, gives us any better capacity to appreciate what might go wrong. I think that's on us, not in the technology. And one of my broader concerns in sculpting the evolution of technology development is that as our technologies become more powerful, our institutions and systems of incentives governing the people developing these technologies and applications need to improve. Because I can talk about ethics and why we need local community control and community-guided development, and if you're engineering a complex system, you should make the smallest possible change that you think has a chance of solving the problem, and then try it at a very small scale and evaluate it carefully by independent oversight, because inventors can't be trusted to rationally and evaluate their creations in an unbiased manner. I can talk about this sort of thing until I'm blue in the face.
Right.
People respond to their incentives. So if you want to change society, you need to change the incentives of the people in question.
Hmm.
And in this case, that's technologists like me. And because I'm at the Media Lab, my incentives really are a little bit different.
Yeah.
It's not just to develop new technologies and publish them in high-profile journals. I'm actually incentivized to try to go out there and make a difference in the world directly and to change the system, even though I'm a young assistant professor. I don't have tenure. But I can afford to do this because I'm being incentivized. So to the extent that I am doing anything right, I don't deserve any applause for it. I'm just following my incentives like everybody else. It's very rare people who actually don't and stand up to do the right thing of their own accord at cost to themselves. So I always call out my students as being the ones who are the real heroes, because if I go out there and share our best ideas for new technologies, most scientists don't do that because if you do, one of your competitors can throw more money in hands at the problem, get it working first, and they get all the credit and you get none.
Yeah.
And then your career can end. For me, it's a little bit different because I get recognized just for doing that and being different. So my incentives lie in that direction. But my students really are putting their careers on the line by agreeing to share their best ideas and their plans and potentially have them stolen by others.
Yeah.
They're the ones who are actually risking something in order to do the right thing.
Fair enough. I get it. And I like the way that you're able to empower your students to be the one. But I do see that risk. You are sticking your neck out there. You're defining a new role for scientists. I mean, what we had Jonathan Lundgren come on, who was a USDA scientist, and he talked about the fact that the USDA, which we think of being somewhat of an impartial program to help folks move us along and listening to scientists, you know, state-funded program. But he talked about the corruption at the level where there were 200 scientists before him, or that actually came out after him when he said his science was being oppressed, that it wasn't being listened to. And the 200 folks followed suit. And he looked at it, that's 200 scientists that waited till after he came forward. You're defining a bit of a new opportunity here. And I would even look at this as a holistic perspective across societies as a collective. I mean, I think we look at all great leaders and they have the ability to put something grander than themselves out there, to look at things for a much more positive perspective, whether you're doing it for your students, whether you're doing it for your kids, or whether you're doing it for society or collective culture as a whole, that matters. Do you feel that is part of your incentive for being involved in this? Have you been enlightened at your young age to see it from that perspective?
I feel that we are here to make a difference in the world as best we can, to learn and grow and find out how we can accomplish the greatest amount of good that we can in our lives.
Hmm.
And the challenge is defining, well, what's the good to whom?
Yeah.
And that's where all the nuance is. But the notion that we should accomplish as much good as we can, that's the overpowering narrative that should govern, I think, everything for ideally everyone.
Yeah.
And we don't, in practice, it's very hard to live your life that way because donate $7,000 to the Against Malaria Foundation, and that's going to save a child's life. Well, who can spare $7,000 to save a child's life? I mean, Peter Singer pointed out that if you're willing to ruin your clothes by wading into a pond to save a drowning child, why aren't you willing to donate the cost of those clothes to save a child on the far side of the world? And the answer is, our moral systems evolved. They're not as perfect as we would like them to be. And so we have to accept that, I mean, it's not quite the original sin doctrine, but it's accept right. That none of us is perfect and is ever going to be perfect, but we must always strive to improve,
yeah. To
think about what are the likely consequences of our actions? What are the likely consequences of the things that we might do? What are the lost opportunities? Some people say that there's a difference between acting and the moral consequences of an action versus the moral consequences of inaction,
yeah. Of
omission, of not doing something that could help others. I think that's a false distinction. I think we are just as morally responsible for choosing not to intervene when our intervention could have helped as we are for the unwanted consequences when we do choose to intervene.
Well, fundamentally, you're putting yourself probably in the 10% to even want to intervene in the first place. So that might be a statement or a barometer of a societal concern to begin with.
I don't know about that because we're in a bit of a bind, really. I mean, so let me just paint the quick scientific narrative.
Right.
Typical scientist says, look, we have less poverty. We have less famine. We have less disease. We have less human suffering by any objective metric you can name.
Yep.
Than ever before in human history. Our challenge is to keep that up.
Right.
Because the cost has been ecological. It's yep. That we use too many resources, more than the planet can sustainably supply.
Yep.
There's too many of us. So we have no choice but to continue inventing, continue discovering new technologies that make us more efficient, that continue this ascent up the tree of knowledge that also allows us to continue to reduce suffering of humans and ideally also of animals. And I think that's one of the areas where we could do the most good, partly because we haven't really thought about it that much before. But so the scientist view is this is a race because civilization is not sustainable. We have been degrading ecosystems. That's been the cost of our success. And we need to invent new things and deploy them fast enough to compensate for the losses, to minimize our footprint on the Earth, to come up with new and more clever ways of fulfilling our needs and helping our fellow humans and the creatures that we share this planet with. My view is a little bit more nuanced. I think that is entirely accurate for the most part, that we have no choice, that we cannot just stop and not intervene. People have this idea, especially strong version of the precautionary principle, says don't do something until you can perfectly predict all the consequences. Mm-hmm. Well, that's lovely if you get to stay where you are if you do nothing.
Right, in a vacuum.
In a vacuum. Yeah. And, you know, the world moves on without you. Children suffer and die. Species go extinct. Ecosystems are degraded. And if we don't do something, if we just stay at our current technological level, then civilization is going to collapse and we're going to go back to the Stone Age. I don't really like that idea.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, possibly because I am responsible, morally speaking, on a personal level, for a technology that was literally unimagined by any human just 6 years ago. The notion that we could readily engineer an entire wild species was something that was completely absent even from science fiction.
Yeah.
As best I can tell, the very concept was not just not there. And now you put together the concepts of CRISPR with gene drive, and it looks like we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're lucky because CRISPR is actually so versatile. It can be programmed to recognize any DNA sequence. And what that means is you cannot build a gene drive that I cannot build one to undo. It's not possible.
Hmm.
And because it spreads over generations, it's slow. And because we're so good at reading out DNA sequences, you can't hide it. So anything that is slow, that is obvious, and that is easily countered is really hard to misuse.
Hmm.
It's just not much of a threat. So we got lucky, because here's this technological capability that is unimagined, that lets a single person potentially unleash something that, if not countered, will eventually spread to affect an entire species and all of the ecosystems that it inhabits. But it's slow, obvious, and is easily countered. So we got very lucky. We were ascending the tree of knowledge. We pushed back the leaves. There was a shiny new fruit from the tree of knowledge, and we tasted it, and it expanded our capabilities. And now we are morally responsible for everything that goes wrong if we do use it. We're also morally responsible for the continued consequences of the status quo when we choose not to use it.
Hmm.
So that's on us, but we're lucky because we can't use it to seriously screw things up. It's a defense bias technology. So my overriding theory is, okay, we got lucky this time. What about the next branch?
Yeah.
Because our systems for anticipating the consequences of our research are inadequate, doesn't begin to cut it.
Yeah.
So my overriding mission, again, is to sculpt the evolution of technology development, to try to change the system so that we have an incentive to share what we're thinking of doing with at least a few other people, ideally with different forms of expertise, before we do it, in areas where we don't think we're immediately going to discover the thing that might bring us all down. Those should ideally be public, because who knows who's going to come up with a valid objection that you might not have thought of otherwise. And that doesn't, you know, necessarily mean don't do it at all. Maybe it does. But it might also just mean do it in this way rather than that way, because that way could end up being very hazardous or have some really nasty unintended consequences.
Hmm.
Those are the kinds of decisions where we really want public input. But why am I concerned? I mean, a lot of people say, isn't this really over the top? Like, is it really possible to have a powerful technology that really could bring us down? Well, the challenge is I can't. If I've thought of such a thing, I obviously can't tell you about it.
Yeah.
And we live in a universe in which it is easier to destroy than to protect.
Yeah.
Thank you, entropy.
Yeah.
So if everyone has access to nearly infinite technological power, that's going to make it easy for a lot of people to destroy things in ways that other people can't prevent them from doing.
Absolutely.
That's why gene drive is the exception, because it is defense bias. But most technologies aren't. So if the next one that we don't see coming is like that, then we're going to be in trouble.
Hmm.
So as I see it now, it's not just a race against ecological collapse and the sustainability problem. It is also avoiding that particular fruit that could endanger everything that we've built.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm different from most scientists. Most think that these kinds of concerns are quite overblown.
Apple in Eden, right? So, and it is fascinating because, as you said, 6 years ago, we had no clue. Even science fiction couldn't have predicted this. 6 years from now, at Moore's Law, who knows, right? I mean, what? And the fact that you're implementing systems because, as you said, you got lucky that this case, this use case scenario has positive outcomes from what we see, or at least it alludes to the fact that we can claw back if there is an issue there. But the next may not have that. The next may not be in the hands of someone like yourself that has this moral accountability. And I think that in itself, maybe we don't, as a general public, know enough about genetic engineering. But that is this underpinning question. And it becomes that same idea of, well, whose hands are wielding this power? And that is a concern. And that's to your credit, man, I think that's fantastic that you're now looking at this, that you've got one of the most revolutionary scientific accomplishments out there, but you're looking at it as a systems change. You've elevated this conversation.
Well, should you trust me to make these kinds of decisions?
I don't know.
Not unless you have to. You shouldn't trust anyone to make these kinds of decisions alone. That's too much to ask of a single person.
Yeah.
I mean, no one should have that put on them, and not least because if you had anything to do with its creation, then you're biased in its favor.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yes, I have had more time to think about the possible consequences of CRISPR-based gene drive than anyone else, but I'm still certainly biased in its favor.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way not to be.
Yeah.
So my judgment is always going to be at least somewhat suspect by that, and that's why I should never make decisions about it by myself.
Yeah. Well, it's a modern rev on peer review, right? I mean, it's like an iteration. It's the whole tree above that. But I get it. I understand it really empowers. Because I'll use it as an example here of, you know, it's in the food world. Sorry, it's easy to get up in arms about GMOs and the evil empires and associated problems with it. But I want to take this as an individual that we lived in Newton, Mass for the last dozen years, but we've recently moved up to the North Shore to Ipswich, Mass, which is stunning. If half the land is in conservation and trustees in perpetuity, it's incredible. But the ticks that breed in that area are just, to be honest, it is one of my wife and my daily concerns about our kids. We do a tick check on the dog, our family, we're always looking for these things because of the fear of Lyme. And I think one of the things that really might hit home for a lot of our listeners here on the East Coast, but really it's going to be everywhere, is this issue of what's happening with these epidemic, pandemic, I don't know what we call the tick issues, and what you're doing with Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket through your lab of opening up these community roundtable conversations to field this information, questions of people, the NIMBY element in your own backyard. But man, this could affect me. I got Lyme, so I don't want to deal with this. How do I solve this? So tell us more, please.
So not too long after the CRISPR gene drive thing, I realized, you know, we really don't have any examples of how to go to communities and ask them how to develop biotechnologies, whether they're interested. There's just vanishingly few examples. There's a couple, World Mosquito Program, formerly called Eliminate Dengue, they'll have a clever way to block dengue transmission by moving a naturally occurring parasitic bacterium that is in a bunch of insects. They found if they artificially put it into the major vector of dengue, then it would block dengue transmission. And so then they said, okay, well, if we introduce enough of these mosquitoes, the bacterium does a weak form of gene drive, biased inheritance. So if we introduce enough of them, then they'll take over the population and block all dengue transmission. So they went to these communities in northern Australia and said, is this something that, you know, we're interested in doing this? What do you want us to look for? What are you worried about? What might happen? And then we'll check for that. And the community came together and, you know, listed all of their concerns. And then those were used to design the field trials, which the community participated in. We wanted to go further because there the problem was like the technology was already there, like mosquitoes with this thing in them. For Lyme disease, there's a bunch of different ways that you might be able to tackle it. But I was interested not just in preventing tick-borne disease, but also in figuring out how should we be going about this process of developing technologies for editing the shared environment in a remotely ethical manner.
Sure. Good POC, right?
And what we... So the basic idea was most ticks out there that get infected with Lyme disease or babesiosis or any of the other nasties that they can give you get it when they bite a white-footed mouse. The white-footed mice are the primary reservoir of all tick-borne infections. We're actually somewhat unique in the world in that there is one primary reservoir of tick-borne disease. It's not true anywhere else in the world. Like, you can get Lyme disease throughout the world, but only here is it primarily due to one reservoir that infects the ticks.
Right. Not the deer, which people think of. It's the mouse.
Deer.
Right?
It's actually the mouse.
Yeah.
More deer means more ticks, which means more infected ticks because passing it back and forth between the mice more readily.
Okay.
So it's a complex ecological cycle, but it's a problem that we created because we got rid of all the wolves, which caused the deer to go up and therefore the ticks to go up. We also converted the land into forests, but we carved it up with roads, so we maximized the forest perimeter. And the species that do best in that are, again, the deer and therefore the ticks, but also the mice relative to everything else the ticks might bite. Mm-hmm. So we simultaneously maximized the number of ticks and the organism most likely to give them disease. Go us.
Unintended consequence, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a problem that we created. And then the question is, what is the smallest possible intervention that has a chance of solving this problem? Well, any given organism, when it gets infected with something foreign to it, its immune system might evolve the ability to recognize and destroy that intruder. The problem with the mice is they don't live all that long. And so often they don't develop a strong enough immune response to fight off the pathogen that causes Lyme disease.
Okay.
Also, they don't have much of an incentive to do it because they've coexisted for so long that they don't get disease. They just get infected.
Yeah.
But you give them long enough, eventually they'll start developing resistance. And so my idea then was, all right, that resistance evolves in individual mice. It's genetically encoded. It just doesn't become strong enough. But what if we stimulate it? What if we just expose them early in life and give them multiple exposures? And then they'll develop strong, genetically encoded, evolved immunity through the natural acquired immunity defense system. And then we can sequence their immune cells, figure out what it is they're using to recognize that pathogen. And then we could encode that DNA using CRISPR back into the reproductive cells of these mice. So we wouldn't be adding any non-mouse DNA in this sense. You know, it would be in a very unnatural context, let's be clear. These mice, this would be genetic engineering. You would never see this normally. It's a normally acquired immunity. You get a cold, you get better, you're immune to it thereafter. No such luck for your kids. This would be unnatural in the extreme. This never happens naturally, but it doesn't involve pulling any DNA that is obviously from some other species. Probably. We're not positive we can do this in exactly this way yet, but there's a good chance that certainly the immunity would rely on that element that arose in a white-footed mouse already. There's a bunch of ways we could go about it, though. We could immunize the mice against just Lyme disease or Babesia or Powassan virus or the individual pathogens. We might also be able to immunize them against the ticks themselves. So to make it so that make a mouse such that a tick bites it and the tick falls off before it gets a full blood meal and then typically dies.
A front guard equivalent, right?
Yeah.
Your dog, sure.
Exactly. So these were options that we thought we could do. And the idea was go to a local community and find out, are you remotely interested in introducing a couple hundred thousand genetically engineered mice? And if so, if tick-borne disease is bad enough that you're willing to consider that, then how would you want them engineered? Against Lyme, against ticks, against both, against, you know, or don't do this at all,
right,
of course. And on the spectrum of, do you want it more natural if possible to versus as effective and as soon as possible, where would you prefer to fall? And somewhat to my surprise, going there and emphasizing, if you're not interested, we're going to walk away. We haven't done anything. We haven't raised money. We haven't done whatever. But here are the technological options that we believe are possible. Are you interested in any of these? And if so, which one? And the community response was rather incredible on both Nantucket and the Vineyard. It was an overwhelming yes, we're interested. Oh. We are seriously interested in releasing a couple hundred thousand genetically engineered mice. And if you're going to engineer them, it was overwhelming response And again, this is just my rough show of hands, no formal vote or anything like that, but it's just get an idea of what people think. And I'm not making any claims as to the representativeness of the community. We've had a lot of subsequent meetings and the responses have largely been the same. But it, which is, if you're going to engineer the mice anyway, then do everything you can. Lime and ticks, if you can make that work, great, please do. But most people, and this is where there's quite a divide, some people feel, look, this is a serious problem. You should do everything you can. It should be as effective as possible.
Yeah.
Other people feel, you know, we really feel more comfortable if you don't use any DNA from any other species. And insofar as you can, with the understanding that making acquired immunity inherited is not natural, we want you to keep it as natural as you can.
Right.
And there's certainly more people in the latter camp.
Yeah.
So that's what we're doing as best we can. And the lovely thing about working with the island communities is they have this very long tradition of New England town hall democracy.
Yeah.
So people always say, well, how do you govern these sorts of things? And the answer is, around here, you just ask the community how they want to do it, and they have mechanisms for doing this. So the boards of health, Board of Health of Nantucket, and then those of each town on the vineyard, appointed members to a steering committee for the project. And each island has their own, of course, because they don't want to share. And we then report to the steering committees and update them on what we're doing and ask them for suggestions or concerns from their neighbors on different ways they'd like to see the project go. And each steering committee has at least one person who is a vocal skeptic of the project. And this is something that we said, you need to appoint them, but we highly strongly suggest that you appoint at least one person who is known to be a skeptic of the project and ideally is on the record as that, or at least is willing to talk to the community and say, I'm not so sure about this. Because we want to hear everyone's concerns and criticism. And particularly in the first vineyard meeting, a lot of people showed up who have been personally impacted by Lyme disease or have seen it really grievously harm the lives of someone that they loved. And I could readily imagine that in that kind of environment, standing up and saying, I don't really know about this. Is tick-borne disease really so bad that we are willing to go this far? That could be very uncomfortable in that kind of environment amongst your neighbors who really have suffered.
Yeah.
But we want to hear that person's objection. That might be something that we haven't thought of. So the idea is that the vocal skeptic on each steering committee will be the channel, will be the person that people can go to and say, I'm really worried about this. And then they can bring it up at the steering committee meeting, so then we can hear about it. And we know that this works, in fact, because of a Nantucket town hall in which someone who did not have a PhD said, well, if you make anti-tick mice and you release them, what's going to happen in that first year? Could the risk of infection actually increase in that first year because of the mice you're releasing? And that wasn't really something that we had thought of. And the answer is no. Introducing already immune mice isn't going to. But if you reduce the native population of the wild-type mice first, that does mean fewer things around for the ticks to bite, the already infected ticks.
Right.
And that means more of those ticks will hang around and possibly be able to infect your kids. So because of that person's concern, the communities might now decide to actually release the mice in a different way. They might decide to release more mice, but not reduce the native population in order to reduce that risk, which will only be there for that first year.
Mm-hmm.
But so now we're a couple of years in, we've been doing some immunology with some collaborators, looking for antibodies from these white-footed mice, and we're looking at how we can express these antibodies in a way that is as natural as possible without interfering with the mouse's immune system. Again, the goal is to make the smallest possible change. We want these mice to be normal in every way, except they're born producing particular antibodies that other mice had that made them immune to Lyme disease or to tick bites. And it's really been a positive experience working with these communities. It's really been an honor, in particular, figuring out how to reach greater fractions of these communities, because, of course, Nantucket and the Vineyard are major summer destinations. The population balloons by a factor of 10 during the summer. And then there's working with the year-round community versus the summer community. There's a lot of differences there. But, and then figuring out how do you reach as many people as possible. I mean, so we've been lucky that we've gotten a lot of media attention and opportunities to sort of tell the story. And then there's been just some amazing, heartwarming stories of how the communities have really taken it up and gone there on their own. So one of the classes of high school students at Martha's Vineyard Regional High School, and their teacher, Dr. Carrie Feiler, did a focus their whole, I think it's an AP science research course, on our project. So they actually got a copy of our grant proposal, because another part of what we do is we share everything, and this is part of the taking the risk, share your idea. Mm-hmm. So all of our grant proposals involving any form of ecological engineering are public. So they just downloaded it and they read it. You know, and we, this is not something that we had written for a general audience. We wrote it for specialists in the field. But they read it, and then they came to us with questions about it, and then they made their own pamphlet, which they called No Time for Lyme, that outlined the project and what it was about and sort of explained the tick-borne disease life cycle. And they gave a talk at the local library that was very well attended on it. And so our hope is that we can, because this is a many years project, you know, we would first need, after we make the mice, we need to breed up enough of them for a small field trial on an island off the coast, ideally mostly uninhabited, ideally with as close ecologically to Nantucket and the Vineyard as possible. Then that would need to be evaluated by independent ecologists who would then deliver a report to the communities, who would then, by their own governance mechanisms, decide whether or not to release mice on their islands. And if so, then you would start, ideally, seeing the tick infection rate go down. And if we can manage to make the mice actually kill the ticks that bite them, then the tick population should also go down. Hmm. Not necessarily by a lot, maybe 50%, but that's still nice. I hate ticks. That's a community decision, right? Because if we only immunized against Lyme, that would be a very minimalist approach.
Yeah.
But you take down the ticks too, that's a greater risk of ecological consequences.
Yeah.
Now, admittedly, the number of ticks is way higher than it's ever been before, so it would be restoring it to a more baseline state, but it's still an extra intervention. But it's one that the communities chose. And they also chose release more mice. Like, don't use CRISPR for anything clever to improve the odds of inheritance or anything like that. That's the sort of thing that we would need to do for the mainland. Because on Nantucket and the Vineyard, you know, there's 100,000-ish mice at the low point at the end of winter.
Yeah.
That's something you can feasibly alter just by introducing enough of them. But on the mainland, there's 1 billion mice. So you need some kind of inheritance advantage. And so we're also working on technologies in parallel that would let any town on the mainland immunize only its own mice and have natural selection actually wipe it out outside of the town boundaries. Turns out you can teach a gene to vote.
Well, that is fascinating for so many reasons. I mean, I can understand having an island as a bit of a petri dish, good test case. You can see what's going on. But I look at that as the test case of almost a social study. The fact that coming out of it, to see a group like that, it makes me wonder, boy, when Cape Wind is trying to get those offshore turbines, they should bring you out there to pitch this, because if you can convince these folks to the value of this. But it is a really, I think it's a great narrative of what you're trying to accomplish at the Media Lab. It kind of encapsulates, it packages it all up of the values you can bring, the extent that you're taking, the systems approach that you're looking at of engaging all of this ecological system that we are part of. And to bring your toolkit to that is very exciting. So, Kevin, maybe you can share with our audience where they can learn more about your work. Is a website the best location at the Media Lab?
Yeah, so the Media Lab has a website describing some of our work. Also, we have our own website, sculptingevolution.org, and we also have a site describing more the community-driven aspects of what we do called Responsive Science.
Responsive Science.
That's responsivescience.org. And then also, if you want to hear more about mice against ticks, John Oliver tells the story in a much more entertaining way than I ever could. So if you want to search for the Last Week Tonight episode on gene editing, there's also a really great documentary on PBS Nova that we're and that our project is featured in, that it that is really great and comprehensive. Okay. So viewers can check, listeners can check out those.
I will. I'll include some links in the write-up and on our iTunes account, and I'll watch them. I'm intrigued. Obviously, I'll watch John Oliver, but I'm intrigued to see the Nova program. I'll close by saying that when I was down there, we had a chance to meet with a lot of the Johns Hopkins individuals from the Bloomberg School of Health. One of the guys there I've gotten to know pretty well and very, very active in this is Bob Martin from the Center for Livable Future. And when we were talking about you, he said, oh, he's like alien smart, like out of this world smart. And I said, okay, I'm excited to talk to him. I get to see your presentation. And I'll say that now in having this conversation, I understand it. And I can understand equally to the fact that your commitment to transparency can also hold true when you're smarter than everybody else, because you're going to continue to innovate, continue to drop new concepts. But to that point, Kevin, you're the approach that you're taking, the degrees that you're doing to have these fail safes, and your willingness to open yourself up to take those types of conversations from individuals that maybe other scientists are not listening to, is a new benchmark. And that's very exciting for us in the food systems, in the ecological systems, in our engagement in having to deal with a shrinking planet with 9 billion people.
Well, that's very kind of you, but I would in fact say that it's precisely because I don't think I'm all that smart, yeah, that I think it's so important that we be transparent and invite concerns and criticism from people who hopefully know more.
Well, very good. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak with us today. I learned a great deal. I know our audience will as well. And I'll just say until next time, Kevin, thank you so much.
Pleasure, Aaron. Take care.